Good morning, everybody. The House State Affairs Committee will please come to order. Would you please take the roll?
Representative Frank Thompson?
Here.
Representative Talarico?
Here.
Representative Stoops?
Here.
Representative Teller?
Here.
Representative Vasquez?
Here.
Representative Spano? Carolyn?
I am here. Again, thank you very much and good morning. We have three bills on the agenda this morning. HB 324, which is, we'll be hearing in HB 280 and HAR 30. And let's begin quickly with HB 324. Would the sponsor of that bill please come forward? Good morning. Please introduce yourself and introduce the bill.
Good morning. My name is Courtney Enright, and I'm a legislative aide for Representative Gabrielle Ledoux. So House Bill 324 amends the membership of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board to expand flexibility and aid in recruitment. The bill is being brought forward on the behest of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and they have struggled in the past to recruit and retain physicians, and so they have asked that we expand the auspices of the board to allow an advanced nurse practitioner. And I believe there's an amendment before you to have a physician's assistant, and we're friendly to that.
Who has the amendment? Yeah, okay.
And that's really as much as the bill does, and so at this point I'd be happy to answer any questions or concerns you have.
What is the reason you'd like to have an advanced nurse practitioner?
Well, in the past, the board has had two different instances where they've been unable to get a physician. Physicians are very busy people that have a lot of obligations on their time. And an advanced nurse practitioner has a suitable amount of medical knowledge that they can speak to really the needs of the board.
I'm personally very pleased with the care of the practitioners. Matter of fact, we have a member in our Senate here, an advanced nurse practitioner. That would be Senator Giesel.
We do.
Okay, do we have any amendments? Do we have any amendments?
Mr. Chair, the amendment we have in front of us was sponsored by Representative Sponholz, and if you like...
Yes, would you present that, please?
I would. Mr. Chair, I move amendment number one labeled A.1.
Okay. Any objection for discussion?
I'll
okay. Any comment on amendment number one? Yes, Representative Keller.
I speak to the objection. It's on page one, line seven, after the word physician. Insert the words a physician assistant. It's a very good amendment myself because, I should let Representative Sponholz speak for herself. Physician assistants are really strong in Alaska.
Yes, I'd like you to note for the record that Representative Sponholz has not joined us. Would you like to say anything about your amendment?
What timing I had this morning, huh?
Great.
Sarah, thank you. So the amendment to add physician assistant, I think, was in my mind, was to recognize sort of the broad scope of paraprofessionals that we have and widen the range of the number of potential applicants that are available for this important board. I know that nurse practitioners can practice independently, which is a fantastic thing, but I think also adding in the potential for physician's assistants, which provide a fairly high level of care, would sort of just broaden the number of applicants that were really well qualified to provide this perspective to the board.
And why did we choose a practitioner as compared to a PA, physician assistant? Was there a reason?
Well, since my amendment is to add in physician's assistants, I don't know why originally we were looking at nurse practitioners. Perhaps that's a better question for the sponsor.
So it would be... you're learning fast.
So through the chair.
So it could be a physician or a PA or an advanced nurse practitioner, correct?
Yes, if you accept this amendment, my understanding is that all three would be eligible to serve in that role.
I think that's good.
Mr. Chair.
Leslie Keller.
Can I ask for an Eddie?
Eddie. Committee comes back to order. Representative Stutz.
I'd like to withdraw my objection on amendment number one.
And Mr. Chair.
Well, no, you.
That's fine.
Okay, don't you want to withdraw the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move to withdraw amendment number one, and it'll, with the understanding here that it'll be reauthored by the sponsor.
Okay, without objection, it's a move. Representative Sponholz.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to propose an amendment that we're calling amendment number one now. Number two.
Right.
It's number two now, isn't it? To HB 324, that on page one, line one, following physician, we also insert, comma, a physician's assistant.
And I'd like to object.
Okay, for discussion. Okay, any discussion on that? If there's no discussion, would you like to?
I would like to remove my objection.
Is there any discussion on the underlying bill? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Keller.
Just to learn a little bit, as long as we have the opportunity here, has there been times that you're aware of that the board was unable to function because they didn't have, or were they just functioning without that expertise when they couldn't get it?
Okay.
Through the chair, Vice Chair Keller, I believe that we have Kate Hudson online who has really staffed this, and she may be able to discuss this a little bit more in depth. To my knowledge, it did create some challenge for them because in order to have a quorum, it's only a three-member board. So when you have one member that can't attend, that does create difficulty in scheduling. And there are crimes that the Violent Crimes Compensation Board talks about that require a certain depth of medical expertise. So lacking that physician did, I believe, create issues. But Kate Hudson is the more appropriate person, I think, to answer that.
Very good. I believe we have somebody about to testify. What is her name?
Kate Hudson is in the room, Executive Director of Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Yes. Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Ms. Hudson. Introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
For the record, my name is Kate Hudson. I'm the Executive Director of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board.
Yes. Please give us your testimony.
So there have been at least two separate year-long periods in the board's recent history where it has been difficult for the board to function, not impossible, but for 1 year there was a physician who simply was an absentee board member. He was unable to attend. He didn't respond to emails. He was just, to all intents and purposes, was not operating as a board member.
Not my position.
And then there was another period of about a year where the board could not find a physician to serve. And then when that happens, there are only three board members, and they have to have a majority to come to an agreement on a claim. And so that simply meant that it was difficult if there are disagreements, as there are fairly frequently, on whether a claimant should be awarded compensation. There has to be a majority of people agreeing. So that can pose difficulties for the board in making their decisions.
Yes. Are these people, board members, paid? Or just expenses or what?
I'm saying no, they are not paid. They're volunteer. They don't receive any stipend at all.
And not even for travel or hotel?
So they only receive travel if they are away from their hometown, and that does not happen very frequently.
Okay, fine. Any questions? Yes. Reverend Keller and then Reverend Vasquez.
I don't mind if you want to.
Reverend Vasquez.
Thank you. I just want to put several things on the record. We have a very good letter dated March 3rd of this year, 2016, from Mr. Gerard Godfrey, Chair of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and he does explain here why a medical professional is in the best interest of the board. Can you just, for the record, explain that briefly?
Yes, through the Chair, Representative Vasquez. Very often what the board is looking at is the case of somebody who has been physically injured as a result of a crime. And they are assessing whether to pay medical bills, whether to pay physical therapy, whether to pay for prescriptions, these sorts of decisions. And having the medical expertise of somebody on the board who can say, well, yes, that's a perfectly reasonable expense to be paying, or that seems to be, given the nature of the injuries, yes, it's quite reasonable, but they are still going back to see the doctor 6 months later. It's really imperative to have that medical knowledge.
That's right. Okay. Reverend Keller.
Yeah, it's just to take opportunity to learn while you're here and appreciate the fact that you're here. So would you just describe in layman's term what the duty is? Do you make recommendations to Department of Administration and, or do you authorize, do you actually have the authorization capability? And just describe the duties, if you would, just to put on the record in general terms.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Keller. The board themselves, the three-member board, do actually have the authority to make decisions. So having reviewed the claim, looking at the police report, the nature of the crime, the nature of the injuries, the treatment and so on, and the expenses that are being requested, the board makes a decision, first of all, whether that person is eligible under the statute, and then secondly, whether the expenses they're asking for are reasonable. And so once it's made a decision on those two things, then the board makes an order, which is, you know, the signed award order form, and then payments are delivered.
That happened to me.
Thank you.
But Reverend Vasquez.
With regard to a little background, how many cases were processed this past year? Calendar year 2015.
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, I'm not sure I can give you the calendar year because we tend to always go through the fiscal year, but I can say for fiscal year 15, there were 960 claims processed, which means the new applications received. Not all of those were awarded. Some are denied. A minority get denied. And then some claims never actually get to the point of making a decision because for one reason or another, we lose contact with the claimant or they're not responding to letters, things like that. But, it's usually in the region of between 800 and 900 claims a year. Last year was a record number.
Thank you.
Do you ever get... Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you ever get direct referrals from the district attorney's office or...
Mr. Chair, yes, we do get direct referrals from the DA's office. We, from the police, from hospitals, from victim advocates, a variety of sources.
Okay. Follow-up.
And what is the most common case that you see or claim that you see in terms of amount and injury?
Through the chair of sensitive aspects, that's quite a difficult question to answer, but I think we have two typical types. We have a lot of assaults, young men who get assaulted through fights in bars or on the streets or at a party or things of that nature. And then we have a lot of injuries, facial injuries, orbital fractures, which can be extremely expensive. So in that sort of a case, we can be paying, I'm going to estimate like $10,000. And it's usually for purely medical because they don't have insurance. The other spectrum is we unfortunately see a lot of child abuse cases. And in those types of cases, we tend not to pay as much because the types of expense that we're paying is usually mental health counseling. So that can be $2,000, $5,000, even up to $10,000 in some cases.
Mr. Chairman? And for the record, how is your agency funded?
Through the chair, we have two sources of funding. We receive an appropriation that comes from the permanent fund dividend. So it's the incarcerated felons whose dividends are not paid to them, and a proportion of that goes to the Department of Corrections, and we also get a small proportion of that. In addition to that funding, we receive an annual federal grant under the Victims of Crime Act.
Chairman? And for fiscal year 2015, what was your total funding?
To the chair, for fiscal year 15, it was $2.1 million approximately total. And that includes our operating expenses and also payments to... through the chair, I want to revise that slightly. It was $2.5 million because approximately $2.1 was what went to victims directly. We have a small operating budget, too.
Okay.
And
one more.
What's your staffing level?
Through the chair, we have three staff members, two including myself, and we're here in Juneau. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd move HB 324 out of committee. That's version alpha as amended with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Okay. Without objection, the bill passes. Short out is while we do the paperwork. Good morning again. We'll now be hearing HB 280, and please introduce yourself, the sponsor of the bill, and give us the title and do your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sam Keto III. I'm representative for District 33, Juneau and Northern Southeast Communities, and the bill you have before you today is House Bill 280. It is a bill that will amend or update, and I guess I can read the short title if that would be
okay. And also, as you go down to the bill itself, would you emphasize where this might save money?
Correct. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you. The bill is basically an act relating to defined benefit tiers for public employees' retirement system and teachers' retirement system, providing certain employees an opportunity to choose between defined benefit and defined contribution plans and public employee retirement plans in the teacher's retirement system, and provides for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, basically what this bill does is provides an opportunity for employees that are currently covered under Tier 4 or new employees coming into the state to choose between a defined benefit program or a defined contribution program.
And today it's all defined contributions, correct?
From 2006, we passed legislation that makes every employee coming in a defined contribution employee. So this bill basically would provide that opportunity for a choice. There is a limited time to be able to transition from a defined contribution to a defined benefit, but it allows for employees coming in that believe they want to pursue a public career either as a teacher or as a public employee to elect to do the defined benefit. If they accrue enough service, they will then be able to receive that benefit. But if they think they might only be working for the state for a short period of time, or if they would prefer to have a defined contribution plan, they can elect that as well. So I think I would like to back up a little bit to basically all the way back to Tier 1, I guess. When the state of Alaska had an original defined benefit program, that benefit program At that time, the IRS allows the states to elect to opt out of Social Security. So because we already had a defined benefit program for retirement, the state of Alaska elected to opt out of Social Security, so it established what was called the Supplemental Benefit System. The Supplemental Benefit System is basically kind of like a 401k. It's a defined contribution component. One of the problems that we've seen for being able to recruit and retain employees in the state of Alaska is with the supplemental benefit system and with the defined contribution system, we end up with employees that have two 401k systems basically and don't have the ability to participate in Social Security. So they don't have the ability to have any component of a defined benefit. And so what this will do is for those employees that want to be long-term, it gives them the opportunity to actually sign up for a defined benefit for state employment or for teachers' employment if they believe that they're going to be in the state long enough. So the vesting is 5 years for the retirement plan, but if you're going to invest in the medical plan, which is actually the more expensive component, then it's a 10-year vesting requirement. And the analysis that's been done for the bill indicates that the bill, properly actuarialized, can save the state about $70 million over 10 years. That's some older numbers. I don't anticipate that would have changed significantly, although maybe we, depending on what's going on with the market, could end up with a little bit more, a little bit less savings.
And these projections are based on new actuarial, can't even say it, actuarial projections?
Updated actuarial analysis. And so what we are also working on right now is working with the Department of Administration to have them provide some additional financial information in the form of their fiscal notes. So we have some updated numbers, and that has not yet been processed, but we are working with the department on that.
Of course, some of the actuarial stuff in, when we changed over here was faulty, you know, and that contributed a lot to the problem we had. Is that correct? And this is somehow figured differently? I know I should be asking an actuarial person, but give us your take on it.
Mr. Chairman, and there are people online that can answer that question maybe a little bit better than I can, but one of the biggest things that we do know is between the 1960s, 1970s, and now, we've seen a significant increase in the expected life. And so the actuarial assumptions have changed, but we've also had some changes in the market that actually made our plans not perform as expected. And so we did end up, and I think we all are aware that we've got a significant liability for our retirement system that is being worked through. But one of the recommendations and one of the things that is passed in this currently in state law is that we are required now every 3 to 5 years to go through and do an actuarial analysis of our retirement plans to make sure that they're actuarially sound. One of the key components, though, is the retirement funding component of this is really a smaller component than the medical component. And so that's one of those things that seems to be driving retirement costs more so, and that is the increasing cost of health care. And that is something that that I think everybody's trying to get a handle on. But with respect to health care in this bill, what it actually does is if you are a firefighter or a public safety officer, you need to have 25 years of experience in order to be eligible for Medicare before you can get health care, or a minimum of 10 years in getting Medicare. And then if you're a public employee, it's a minimum of 30 years of service or a minimum of 10 years of service and eligible for Medicare in order to receive the health care benefits. Otherwise, you're paying a percentage or the full amount for your health care.
Did you have a question? I saw you getting ready there. Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. In your sponsor statement, you make the statement that this bill saves the state money. And and you just indicated that the biggest driver is medical costs. So the statement that you made is true, based on the information and the projections that you have. My question is, in the case that you would be wrong and that the risk of the rising rate of medical care and medical care costs goes over what is proposed and anticipated in the plan, who takes the risk here? Who is it that picks up the risk on that if there is a cost?
Through the chair, Vice Chair Keller. Sorry. So the way I described that earlier is there is a shared risk. So if you are fully vested on Medicare, then you're eligible to receive health care benefits, and then the state health care plan becomes secondary. So the state is paying for those costs, but it's a smaller amount for those costs because Medicare is primary. For individuals that are not Medicare eligible, then they're paying their full premium. And I think there are others that can actually that have more detail on the medical side of things. But it is a shared because you have to have quite a bit of service in order to qualify for a graduated or up to a full medical benefit. Otherwise, you're, as an individual, paying that premium. So that's where you have that shared risk. So the individual that is receiving the care, unless they've got that 25 years of service for a public safety or firefighter or 30 years of service for a public employee, that they would not be eligible to receive that medical benefit.
Follow up.
So that again presumes that is not that shared risk. The amount on both sides would vary depending on how fast and how big the medical care costs. I just wanted to say that I was here as staff and had very firm statements that that the retirement system was in sound condition. And so these things can be wrong, and I just want to move really slow and make sure I understand it before we go there. Especially in light of what's happening in other states. I was just reading last night where Puerto Rico, their defined benefits retirement, is 2% funded. In other words, Puerto Rico is bankrupt, and Congress is trying to figure out what to do with it. And it's a very, very painful situation in many states they're in, and we're one of the top 10, in dealing with the mistakes that we made. But anyway, that was more a statement, Mr. Chair, but it was more just to confirm that even with a shared risk, our state share of that picking up that risk, if this is wrong, is there, even though it's not quantifiable at this point.
Chair, Vice Chair Keller. Yes, there will be a shared risk at this point as opposed to having the employee pick up 100% or the state pick up 100%.
Okay, and I received a. You listened to. Okay. There may be some potential conflicts of interest. I'm going to rule that you will be required to participate and to vote if it comes to a vote. On this committee, on this bill. And of course, all of us here at this table are state employees, and it's different tiers depending where we are. I assume much of the audience also, state employees, but you don't get to vote anyway. But if you did, we just cancel the meeting and leave. It'd be all over. Could you continue, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that's pretty much my broad overview. There are people that have much more information on a higher level of detail. There's a Mr. Fornia online that should be available to go through.
And we have some actuarial people.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Help us with that. Okay, what's the name of the person?
The first one is Jason Duncombe. He's an Anchorage police officer. Are you online?
Okay. Yes, sir, I'm online.
Yeah, please introduce yourself and your affiliation and give us your testimony.
Yes, sir. I'm Officer Duncan with Anchorage Police Department. I'm going to be testifying today on behalf of House Bill 280. I'm a family guy. I have four beautiful children as well as a wife. I feel that an option for a retirement would help benefit my family in a lot of ways with being able to apply, monetary values in the future towards my kids' college and aspects like that. In speaking with fellow officers, I've come to kind of a realization that APD, the way it sits right now is that, you know, without a retirement, there's not really a future for a lot of us. In my academy class, we had 23 different other officers that went through the academy with me. In speaking with you guys, we've all come to the realization that there's other, you know, other departments that are offering a retirement. And, you know, a lot of these are in, like, Idaho and Washington, and that there's options for us to go elsewhere to, you know, potentially seek a retirement. And without APD, you know, having this in plan, it's kind of, you know, it obviously affects us, and I think it's kind of affecting our retention and, like, having us stay here. I know at least seven other officers that I've spoke to that have, obviously, similar concerns on the matter, and that they are seeking a retirement. I've made Alaska my home. I love Alaska. APD is a family to me. I really enjoy my job with APD, and I'd like to stay here. But without a retirement, I just don't know if there's actually a future for myself and my family to be able to stay in Alaska, just with, you know, the thought of having to, you know, apply myself more and not be able to put money towards my kids and their future. Basically, this time I can waive the remaining time to answer any further questions from you guys.
Okay, fine. Thank you. I'd like to thank you for your service too on the police department.
Well, you're welcome, sir. Thanks.
And any questions for the officer? If not, thank you again. And what they used to say in the old TV program, stay safe out there.
Thanks, sir.
Okay, and
William Fornia?
Are you in the room, sir? Or online?
No, online.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. This is William Fornia calling from Colorado. And you all can hear me okay?
Yes, we hear you.
Yeah, we hear you. Tell us who you represent or what your specialty is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'm a consulting actuary with my own firm, Pension Trustee Advisors, and my client in this case is the Alaska Public Pension Coalition. I've been working with them since 2011 on various matters, and I also worked for the Retirement Management Board, the ARM Board, 2005 through 2006. I was their advisory actuary, and then I performed an audit of the PERS and the TERS system in 2008. I have a wide variety of types of work that I do. I work for governments, I work for the pension funds, I work for labor organizations, and then I work for third parties occasionally. I heard Representative Keller mention Puerto Rico a few minutes ago. I was, up until about a year ago, I was special advisor to the Puerto Rico Retirement Systems. I also worked for the banks involved in the Detroit bankruptcy. I testified in federal bankruptcy court on behalf of those banks. Also have testified or spoken to the Federal Reserve, the federal district courts, and to 12 legislatures around the country. Today I'm going to spend about 15 minutes on a presentation, which I believe you all have. Is that correct?
Just a moment. Do we have that?
It's a 29-page PowerPoint.
Fine. My assistant here helped me find it. Okay, please continue. Everybody find this in the book? Everybody got it? But Ms. Reverend Christ Tompkins, do you have it? Oh, on the computer. Okay. He's our tech person here. Okay. Please begin the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So page two is the agenda. Basically, I'll talk a little bit about how the legislation would work, although Representative Keto did a pretty thorough job, I believe, in describing that. I'll talk a little bit about why a defined benefit plan, having an option for that is important, particularly for you all. I've got some financial numbers and then some actuarial discussions as well. So on page three, really the key features of this plan is that it gives these employees a choice between the defined benefit and the defined contribution plans. Some employees would prefer a defined contribution plan, typically if they're shorter service or they're younger. I was the actuary at Boeing Company in the 1980s and saved a lot of money through their 401k, and even though I was only there for 4 years, that's been very valuable to me. But then DB plans are very popular particularly for career workers. And so this legislation is structured to be cost neutral or better. The idea was that, you know, we don't want to have unfunded liabilities built up, and we don't want this to cost the state more than the current defined contribution DCR program, defined contribution program costs. And so we think we've done that. Hopefully the fiscal note will confirm that. The fiscal note from a couple of years ago actually showed a $10 million savings in the first year, and, you know, we're waiting to see what those will be. The workers are going to contribute the same as they're contributing to the current tier. So the workers wouldn't have a preference between one plan or the other in terms of what they contribute. It's designed to have short-term cost savings. And then a lot of the risk, I think Representative Keller a few minutes ago asked about the risk of getting the healthcare costs wrong. As the healthcare costs go up, the benefits are going to be reduced, and there will be shift of costs to the workers. So, you know, we do anticipate that healthcare costs are going to go up faster than payroll, and so as a result, there would be a shift in the cost for that. Then moving on to page four, basically, what I'll spend a few minutes talking about is why having an option is more economical, because you can provide a lot more benefit for per dollar if it's through a defined benefit structure as opposed to a defined contribution structure. And once again, this plan was designed to be cost neutral. This is similar to bills that were in 2014 and prior, and, you know, and as a result of one of the fiscal notes, there were some changes made to it to keep it cost neutral, because I think that's the goal of everybody here, is that we if anything, we want to save money through this plan, not have the state on the hook for more money. Moving on to page five. And also, Mr. Chairman, please, if anyone wants to ask questions as I go along, I'm very comfortable with that approach.
William, the chair passed the gavel to me for a few minutes here. He has something in. Representative Sponholz has a question for you.
Hello, Mr. Farina. Through the chair, you just stated that a defined benefit plan is more economical, and I think one of the things that I grew up hearing was that a defined contribution was more economical, and that was part of the reason that we made the shift from a defined benefit to a defined contribution over the years. Could you flesh that out a little bit more and bring me up to speed?
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz. The defined benefit plan is more risky to this employer in general, but it's not more economical because the employers are better positioned to take the risk. So if an employee is forced to take the risk of their own retirement, they make decisions that are not as economical as if the employer does it. And actually, that I've got probably 3 or 4 minutes. I'm going to discuss that in the middle of my presentation. So if you wouldn't mind, let's kind of park that question until I get to page 8 through about 13 of my presentation. Is that okay, Mr. Chairman and Representative Sponholz?
Yeah, William, I'm getting a nod. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Back to page 5. I think we've kind of covered that. Page 6 is just some numbers on the level of benefits for some of your average people. And for example, the average teacher is hired at age 34, and if she works 25 years, I made it a she in this example, under the current, if she was in the defined benefit plan under the most recent tier, tier 2, I guess it is, she'd have a benefit of 58% of pay. But if she had to save that money through the Tier 3 defined DCR plan, the defined contribution retirement benefit, her benefit would only be 33% of pay, which is a reduction of 25% of pay per year for the rest of her life. Similar numbers for police and firefighters and for the other public employees. PERS is the public employee retirement system, as I suspect you all know. So page 7 then just looks at this teacher, that has a typical, say, a $50,000 average salary at retirement. You know, she'd get about $28,000 if she was in the Tier 2, but if she had had her whole career saving into the Tier 3, she'd only have about, $17,000. Whereas her neighbor that has only Social Security would have, nearly as much, $14,000 or $13,000. So what I'm trying to show here is that, the benefit levels, and this is the reason the labor group wants this, the benefit levels under the Tier 3 for teachers, Tier 4 for PERS, are just really not enough to retire on. Whereas under the old plan, it was a lot closer. Now to answer Representative Spenholz's questions over the next few pages, I wrote a report, and it's cited down at the bottom, and I apologize. I don't know if you all heard. We had a tremendous blizzard in Denver yesterday, so I have a suitcase full of these reports I was going to pass out that are still with me here in Colorado. I wasn't able to get out, but this report shows, and I co-authored this report with the National Institute on Retirement Security and updated it in 2014. And basically, there's three reasons to answer Representative Spanholz's questions. That these plans are more economically efficient. To me, the most obvious one is what I'm calling longevity risk pooling. Because PERS and TRS, TERS, have large groups of people, the plan is, the actuaries are really good at figuring out, relatively closely how long the people are going to live. But like me, I'm an individual. I've got mostly defined contribution money. I'm 57 years old, and I have no idea how long I'm going to live. I might live to only 67. I might live to be 97. And so as an individual, you have to save extra because you don't know how long you're going to live. But the pension fund, that's a collection of individuals, doesn't have to do that. I have a couple of charts that show how that works. The second advantage is that me, now that I'm 57, I'm starting to phase out of my risky investments. I'm investing less in the equity markets. Whereas when I was 25, 27, I was able to invest more in the equity markets. And an individual has to phase down as they get older. But the TERS and PERS doesn't have to. They're pooled. They've always got a long, long time horizon. So they can continue to take riskier investments, which some years won't work out. But in the long run, they're expected to provide higher returns. And then finally, the PERS and TERS are just better investors than the average individual. Now, I'm an actuary. I think I'm a smart guy. So maybe I'm close to as good as the PERS and TERS. But the average other public employee is not going to be as good as the average professional. Plus there's extra expenses that they have and so on. So there's just these three kind of fundamental reasons that make the plan more efficient. I've got some charts, but in the interest of time, I won't go through those.
William, if I could just interrupt a little bit, a question. This is Representative Keller. I just want to clarify for the record that the report that you referred to is the one that is cited down on the bottom of slide 8, which is Still a Better Bang for the Buck, National Institute of Retirement Security 2014.
Mr. Representative Keller, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thanks. Another question I have is actually just help me understand, but the study and the work that is done is based on the same amount of money up front. In other words, I think in a slide previous it said that the employee pays the same both DCA and DB, and does it also presume that the employer is paying the same, or what I'm saying is the same amount of money that gets invested and you get superior returns, as you have pointed out, on the retirement system, we're talking the same amount of money. We're not talking about more money in the case of to work with in the case of DB than we are DC, right?
Representative Keller, yes, that's a very important point, and I apologize I didn't make that clear, but that's exactly the idea. It is for the same dollar that's spent, whether it's spent by the employee or by the employer, I didn't care in this particular analysis. It's just a certain amount of money is going in. How much are we going to get out? Or conversely, to pay the same level of benefit, how much money needs to go in? But it definitely wants to be apples to apples, and I thank you for clarifying that.
Thank you. You may have said it very clearly, and I missed it. Thank you.
Continuing on, Mr. Chairman. So page 9 just says the same points I said. Page 10 shows that kind of graphically. So these bars at the bottom, and hopefully yours are in color, and the bottom bars are red, and that's for a pool of 1,000 teachers. If they were to have saved through a defined contribution plan, then they would and wanted to add a certain target level of benefit, that those bottom bars, which are red in my case, show how much they pay themselves in pensions. But what happens is a lot of these teachers would die earlier than average, or in some cases later than average, and the gray bars, the top half of those bars, is money that would go to their estates. So this money, it's still a nice thing to have, but it's not a retirement benefit. It's a death benefit for their spouses and for their kids, perhaps. So what happens is if we fund the defined contribution plan, these individuals are going to have to save extra and pay themselves less in terms of retirement benefit. And the result is that they'd have, as they die, that money would be going to their estates instead of to their themselves as pensions. It's not a waste of money. It's just the wrong money. It's money that if our goal is to provide these public servants a retirement of dignity and adequacy, we have to give them extra if we did it through a defined contribution plan. And that's the point of this chart, to show that longevity pooling differential. In the interest of time, I'm going to move quickly through slide 11. 12 just shows this graphically how a 62-year-old would be have a higher expected rate of return.
Yeah, just a moment, sir. We have a question here, I believe, representing Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. This is a question on the previous slide, slide 10. So for teachers that live longer than expected, basically, in this slide, they would have to sort of come up with a difference or sort of scrum in their retirement. And then for teachers that might die earlier than expected, such that there's expected death, you have this death benefit and basically a lack of a retirement benefit being realized. So it seems like sort of be swing either direction, and you have an unideal outcome. Am I understanding what you're saying correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Christ Thompson, yes, that's exactly right. And the problem is they don't know up front if they're going to live longer than expected or less than expected, whereas TERS and PERS does. I mean, they don't know who is going to live longer than expected, but they know on the average some will live longer and some will live shorter, and therefore they don't need as much money in a defined benefit vehicle.
Reverend Craig Tompkins, follow up. Representative Vosges, and then Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fournier, I have a few questions. I am, for the record, I am looking at slide number 10. title under DC plan, 24% of assets are not used for retirement / 1,000 sample teachers. The sampling, where, from what geographic jurisdiction is the sampling taken for? What, and what specific assumptions are made for the creation of this graph? There must be numerous assumptions.
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, this was actually done on a national basis using a kind of a standard mortality table about 4 years ago. And, you know, for Alaskan experience would probably be somewhat different. I don't know if you have, I don't know how your mortality patterns vary compared to the national basis before, but the shape would still be basically the same. You know, maybe the lines would be a little higher or lower. But the idea is still, you know, pretty much for any population, you'd find out the same thing. And we actually, when we did the report, when we updated the report in 2014, we took two different populations. We looked at police and firefighters that retired young, and we looked at teachers that retired at 62. And we found, you know, very, very, very little difference in the full outcome because we wanted to make sure that we hadn't cherry-picked the population that, that looks one way or the other.
Follow-up, Representative
Vasquez. Mr. Fournier, can you please provide to the committee members the list of assumptions made under slide 10? And I also see slide 6 is full of assumptions, and we don't know what those assumptions are. For instance, that the higher age for teachers is on average 34 years old. That, from what I know, my knowledge here in Alaska, seems to be on the older side. The retirement age also seems to be on the older side. The years of service, I think, for state of Alaska, historically, has been 20 years instead of 25 years. I just think that this may not totally reflect Alaska. Alaska, for so many reasons, is so different from the rest of the United States. So I like to see charts that reflect actually data taken from Alaska instead of national data. We do tend to deviate substantially at times from the national statistics.
Comment, please.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Vasquez. Okay, page 6 was Alaska data. This was a few years ago, the average higher age for each of these three groups. It might have changed in the last 2 or 3 years, but this was based on, I believe it was 2012 information. And then the 25s that were picked for police and fire, for teachers, were because that's what this plan, the bill, requires to get health care. And then the PERS, age 60 was picked because that was a typical retirement age in Alaska. But I would be happy to provide all of the other assumptions for both charts on page 6 as well as pages 10 through, I guess it would be 10 through 13 or 14. And I'll get those through the bill sponsor to all of you.
And how long do you anticipate to get that? I don't know if you can answer.
Mr. Chair, I could have those tomorrow.
Representative Keller.
I hesitate. I'm not trying to slow the process down here, but William, if you would, please define oversavings again. I think you did in your comments, but I'm grappling with understanding. So if you would, in a sentence or two again, what is that gray area on the chart?
Ms. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, basically that's the amount that is provided in when an individual dies, you know, so each one of those lines is the group of people that were alive at that year. And so the oversaving part is this extra money that came out of their 401ks or their defined contribution plans when they died. So if I die at 74, but I've saved enough to last till 94, there's going to be all this money left in my account. that's not going to be used for my retirement benefit. It's going to be used for my spouse's and my kids' death benefit. So I have to save extra because I don't know when I'm going to die. Whereas the pooled pension fund doesn't have to do that. The pooled pension fund, if it's just targeting pensions, it only has to save enough to pay the bottom row of payments, not the top line of payments.
Thank you. That helped.
Did that take care of it?
No.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And moving forward, I think page 13 just is some data. There have been numerous studies over the years that look at the average returns of defined benefit plans versus defined contribution plans. And I just cited a few of those. When I provide the extra assumptions as requested by Representative Vasquez, I'll give you the reports that have all the backup data on all that stuff, because that was an important part of our analysis too. Is this 1% spread between the returns in defined benefit versus returns on defined contribution? And basically, the conclusion was that it's about half. So you can provide about half the level of benefits for the same dollar if you're using defined contribution versus a defined benefit, which is somewhat consistent with the numbers on slide 6 that were asked about before. Now, slide 6 was Alaska-specific for these three plans, and then this study on slides 8 through 13 were the national study. This report had been updated in 2014. Slide 14 is a little more information that is more recent. I don't know. I don't recall. I apologize if any of you heard a similar testimony by me in either 2014 or 2012. But I wanted to update that with some more information. And these four items on page 14, I'm going to spend a minute or two on each. Page 15 is the update on this report that we did in 2014. And again, the second bullet probably is clear. There's been this misperception that defined contribution plans inherently save money. And basically, they save money if you decide to put less in. But if you don't decide to put less in, they don't save money, and in fact, they provide lower benefits. And there'd been some pushback. There'd been some reports. The co-author of this report, the original report, has testified to Congress with this information, and there's been some discussion over them. So we updated everything to reflect some changes that had happened since between 2008 and 2014. Page 16. Is just a quick summary of, I believe you have a five-page written report from the National Institute on Retirement Security. Is that also in your packet, Mr. Chairman?
I don't know. Hold the line just a moment, please. Okay, I think we have it.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to go through that report, but slide 16 and 17 just kind of summarize that. So this group, and I did not write this report. I just was aware of it, so I thought it would be good to bring it to your attention. There had been three states over the years that made the switch from defined benefit to defined contribution, and you're one of them. You made the switch in 2005, 2006. And so this report basically tried to look at various issues on how that change had been going, and page 17 is kind of their conclusions, and the conclusions are that it did not really help solve the underfunding problem, and in many cases it increased the cost of the plan. The report also showed that the workers in the new plan had increased levels of insecurity towards retirement. And then the report concludes the best way to address your underfunding problem is not to make a switch, but just to have a responsible funding policy. So if you're all interested, you know, read through that report. There's a couple pages on Alaska, a couple pages on Michigan, a couple pages on West Virginia, but it kind of provides some context to, you know, to the national scene on this type of switch. Then page 18. So every year, Buck, who's the actuary, I'm sorry, every few years, you know, the actuary for a pension fund, you know, the best policy is for them to go back and look at how the experience they thought they would have compared with the experience they actually did have. And Buck, like most actuaries, does this. And the most recent study they did was in 2014. And what they did is, you know, these actuaries make all these assumptions going forward, and then you correct for them when they're wrong, but you also want to go in and see if you need to change the assumptions going forward. I mean, the simplest example is, you know, if you assume you earn 8%, you know, then last year you only earned 6. Well, obviously you don't pretend you earned 8. You just, you recognize the fact you only earned 6. But you might also want to think going forward, do we want to change the 8 down to something less? And, you know, mortality, all the assumptions work that way. Retirement age, turnover, you know, with terminations, withdrawals, investment returns, salary growth, and everything. And in fact, like I said, Buck did do this in September and reported it in November of 2014. So, you know, part of my job, I looked at the assumption review, but I really wanted to pay particular attention to the terminations, you know, people quitting that had less than 5 years or less than 8 years, because that's the way Buck broke this down, because that would be some evidence that perhaps this new plan, you know, anecdotally we've heard about, you know, people leaving teaching or leaving police and firefighting, and you know, so we wanted to look and see if there's any evidence in that report that perhaps this was happening. And page, hang on a second, I apologize, I got my pages wrong. Page 22, excuse me, and I'll come back to these other pages. But page 22, I'm sorry, page 23 is the conclusions from what I put on page 22, and I apologize, also on page 18. Basically, teacher turnover, if you look at page 23, was 12% higher than they had expected, and police and firefighter turnover was 4% higher than they expected. And this period of time was 2009 through 2014. So normally that in a recession, you would expect turnover to be lower than expected because it's harder to go get another job. So I think there's some evidence here that you know, your groups of people with short service are quitting, you know, more rapidly than the actuary would have expected. And, you know, again, Buck didn't do this study with a focus on has DCR changed turnover, but I think we can glean a little bit of information from that they did. And jumping back, if you don't mind, to page 19 and 20, in the interest of time, I'll go very quickly through these, but this is another study that was done by the University of California. There has been some discussion that maybe teachers or others are better off with a 401k than a pension. And so this study was done by the University of California for California State Teachers Retirement. And page 20, the conclusions here is that the vast majority of teaching done is done by long career teachers. And so even though some of them might quit early and have preferred a DCR type of approach, for the vast majority, they're better off with a pension. And page 21 kind of confirms that. And then I apologize, I did 22 and 23 already. So 24, and then I'm almost done. And I'm happy to take more questions. Basically, your unfunded liability has grown since the plan changes were made in 2005. The Senate Bill 141, you know, wasn't designed to solve the unfunded liability problem, and it hasn't. This DB option that we've designed, or that has been designed, was specifically designed to not increase unfunded liabilities. The actuaries have some conservatism built into their assumptions, and as long as if those happen, it would actually improve the unfunded liabilities. These plans are funded in advance so that they don't have future problems. And then again, page 25 is a conclusion. You know, the top chart part is what I've just been saying, how it helps provide a safety net and encourages long-term service. And then the bottom bullet is just confirming, you know, this plan was specifically designed to try to be cost neutral or favorable. There's a feature with the health cost risk being shifted to the employees. There's stronger contributions and so on. And why don't I just quickly gloss through 26? I think was already discussed. 27 shows the contributions, and then 28 is nothing new there. Finally, page 29 is just our conclusions, and Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take some more questions if there are any.
Very fine. Thank you for your exhaustive presentation here. Questions from the committee, please? Any questions? Representative Vazquez.
Okay. Mr. Fournier, everybody generally knows that we have an unfunded liability right now. What is the projected benefit of implementing this to the existing retirement plan in the underfunding situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vazquez, this program is not designed to improve the unfunded liability. However, if the new fiscal note confirms that there's some savings, then that could be used towards the unfunded liability. I don't believe it's designed to be paid for the unfunded liability. But in the long run, this is just one more piece here that's not anticipated to increase the unfunded liability. And if experience is more favorable, it could have some positive impact on the unfunded liability. But that was not the purpose of this proposal. Go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
So in other words, any money that we might save from this program could be used to pay down unfunded liability or for anything else. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Thank you. Okay. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, sir. Hope you can hang around. We have some other people testify, I believe, on the line here.
We have Robert Grave, and he's in the Fairbanks LIO, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Grave, are you there?
Yes, and it's Robert Grove, G-R-O-V-E. Thank you, and good morning. I'm the Legislative Information Director of the Retired Public Employees of Alaska, RPEA, which has chapters in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. I've lived in Alaska for 46 years, and I've retired twice, once from the fire service in 2000, and the second time from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geophysical Institute in 2007. Collectively, my wife and I have over 52 years of public service in Alaska. Like many retirees, we made a decision to remain in Alaska after retiring to be near our family, and we want to stay here till we reach the end of our life. According to the Institute of Social and Economic Research, ICER, the impact of Alaska seniors on the economy in 2015 was more than $3 billion. ICER research points out that this income stream does not depend on oil, fish, or gold. that is influenced by, it's not influenced by world markets, and it's not seasonal. If you include formal and informal volunteer work by seniors, there's a contribution in the realm of about $52 million annually, and an additional $47 million in the performance of caregiving activities. RPEA supports HB 208 and its companion bill, SB 88. These bills create the opportunity for new state employees to choose if they want to participate in today's defined contribution retirement account, similar to what is currently known as PERS Tier 4, or participate in a new defined benefits pension plan. According to the National Institute on Retirement Security, retiree expenditures in 2014 and state and local pension plans benefits supported 16,054 jobs in this state. HB 208 creates a new, more stable, more predictable defined benefit pension tier plan for teachers, troopers, firefighters, and other public employees. As was mentioned by Ms. DeFornia, it's in the best interest of the state of Alaska and retirees to have more retirees contributing into the PERS and TERS pension trust, which this legislation will make possible. Both as an individual and on behalf of RPA, I strongly urge this committee to support this legislation and pass it out of committee. Once again, thank you for allowing me to testify before you concerning this important fiscal legislation. By the way, currently there are 39,679 PERS and TERS retirees. And if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir, for your testimony. Any questions? Thank you again. I believe the rest of our testifiers are in the room here someplace. Mr. Vice Chair, would you tell me who's next on the list?
Nathan Kostubis.
Nathan, are you here? He's coming for us.
Eight more.
Good morning,
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm Nathan Kostubis, and I work for Dillingham City Schools. I've lived in Dillingham for 6 years.
You're considering of representative advice?
I didn't catch that, sorry.
Never mind. Continue.
Okay, all right. Thank you. So I teach high school science. I also teach speech and debate. I'm here to speak in favor of HB 280. As you know, HB 280 will allow public employees, including teachers, to choose between defined contribution and defined benefits in their plans for retirement. This will create several significant advantages for Alaska. This includes keeping experienced educators in Alaska, making it easier for schools, especially in the bush, to attract new talent, and all with a more efficient use of our education dollars. So I'm going to focus today just on the efficient use of the education dollars. As we all know, teacher turnover is an enormous concern for us here in Alaska, especially in the bush. Right now in Dillingham, we've lucked out. We have a great new cohort of young early career teachers. I'm talking 10 to 12 teachers out of a total staff of about 40. We've made good hires. And we, both district administration and veteran teachers such as myself, we've invested a ton, both money, time, and effort in training those new teachers, getting them up to speed. And the downside, of course, is that every single one of those teachers plans to leave Dillingham and Alaska in the next couple of years. That's about a quarter of our teaching staff right now. In effect, Dillingham is acting as a teacher graduate school for other states. We train our teachers up so that they are effective and wonderful and make that positive impact every day. And then we watch them move on. And this happens all over Alaska. Now, this is an extremely inefficient use of our state's education dollars. It takes a really big investment to make a good teacher. Teachers are made. They're not born. You have to invest. You have to train them up. And when new teachers leave because our current retirement system, we, districts and the state, we have to make that big investment again and over again after that. HB 280, by providing an attractive retirement option, will help to keep teachers here and will help stop that constant, financially inefficient turn of teacher turnover. Education is not rocket science. I contend it is a much, much more difficult proposition than that. HB 280, if enacted, would provide a significant, meaningful, and critical step in the right direction, keeping good teachers here and using our education dollars wisely. My ask for you today, please support HB 280. Help to build the momentum to make this into law. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I too am a retired teacher, actually from the California system, not here. And, you know, us teachers, we all have our frustrations wherever we teach. And I might not have stuck with it had it not been for the defined benefits that it had in California.
Yeah.
And I could say the same for my military career. Next.
Chris Benchu.
I beg your pardon. Reverend Christ Compton.
Thank you. So Nathan, let me see if I understand the sequence. You've got young teachers that come out to rural Alaska to Dillingham because it's their first job or one of their first jobs since graduating school. And once they get situated and sort of get their feet under them professionally and sort of maybe look out a little bit more into the horizon and what their future family retirement looks like, that's when you start to see this sort of out-migration of teachers. I'm just trying to get a sense of the chronology.
Yes, that is true.
Yeah.
You know, like as a state, I think we have to import something like 70% of our teachers. We need strong incentives to keep them here. You know, as they get their professional feet under them, as they learn their trade, as they get good, they feel the call of their family back down south. They feel the fact that essentially every other state has a better teacher retirement system than we do. And so we get them here, we train them up, and then they have, they're making the rational choice on their own to seek greener pastures elsewhere.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Why did they come here in the first place?
A lot of folks come here for the sense of adventure. A lot of folks come here because they have a sense of, it's perhaps easier for a professional to start a career here than elsewhere down south. So they're here for adventure. They're here to get their careers going.
One final question.
One point. Go ahead.
Do you know, we've got tier four, tier three, I guess it is. Do you know, has anyone retired from that system? And if so, what are their health care benefits looking like?
From the current teachers, tier three, purse four? I don't think anyone, I'm not sure of this one. I don't think anyone's retired. It's only 10 years old, more or less. I do know, just kind of, I sit down with my wife. We gaze into our financial crystal ball. I'm in tier three. This is my six-year teaching, so I'm a teacher tier three. The numbers don't look good for us, either healthcare-wise or in terms of my benefits after I retire, which might be at a very old age at this point. Does that answer your question?
Kind of, if I may.
Yes.
Follow up, what do you mean by, what do the healthcare members in particular look like when you and your wife gaze into the financial crystal ball?
Through the chair, the short answer is the healthcare numbers look very, very expensive. And the risk is borne by me and my family.
Thank you, Representative Stewart.
Well, you somewhat answered my question. My question to you was going to be, how long have you been teaching in Dillingham? And I heard you say 6 years.
Yes.
And you're one of the longest surviving teachers there, for lack of better terms.
Through the chair, the answer to that is sort of. I am a veteran teacher there, only in my sixth year. we have a strong cohort still of folks who are TRS Tier 2 and even Tier 1 who are there still. So those are the real veterans. You know, we have some folks, they're all getting, in, you know, near to the age now where they're about to, you know, about to call it quits. But in terms of the, you know, in terms of the Tier 3 teachers, you know, we do have that, that constant turnover. I think I'm the most experienced of our Tier 3 teachers. I'm one of two only that have actually bought a house in Dillingham in the past since 2007. You know, so we have that cohort of Tier 1 and Tier 2 teachers still who are invested in town and have been for 20-plus years. But the younger tier, Tier 3, you know, two of us have bought houses in the last 9 years. That's that shows the kind of turnover churn that we have.
Have you taught any place before you came to Alaska?
No, I was a biologist for many years. I'd been in Alaska probably for about a half a dozen years before I switched to education.
Fine, thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Who's next? Somebody down there?
I just have a general question. Thank you for testifying this morning, and I don't think you would have the expertise to answer this question. I know that historically there's been high attrition rates. I've been in Alaska almost 33 years, so out in the bush, it's generally known that it's hard to recruit teachers and it's hard to retain. And you're not going to be able to answer this, but someone should be able to answer. I would like to see the statistics, specifically the attrition rates before and after Tier 2, Tier 3, and Tier 4, and you would not have that expertise, so I want to throw that out, because I think it's, stats sometimes are counterintuitive, you know, so, but, and thank you for your service, by the way.
Certainly.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for coming in. Who's next?
Thank you.
Chris Benchu.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. My name is Chris Benchoff, and I teach math, statistics, computer science, engineering, and robotics at Lathrop High School in Fairbanks. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill...
Which high school?
Lathrop High School, the school I graduated from. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 280, which would provide educators and public employees an option between a defined contribution and a defined benefit retirement system. In my 8 years teaching, I've been recognized as the 2013 State Teacher of the Year, a 2014 National Teacher of Excellence, and I'm currently a finalist for the 2015 Presidential Award for Excellence in Math and Science Teaching.
Congratulations on all that.
Thank you. In those same years, however, the Defined Contribution Retirement Plan has harmed our state's recruitment and retention efforts to try and get the excellent teachers we need. I was hired for my full-time math position at Lathrop High School in the fall of 2008. And I've been told that at the time I was one of 65 applicants for the position. I consider myself very fortunate to have been hired from such a deep pool. But as understanding of the defined contribution system has grown, interest in teaching our community has fallen drastically. Just last fall, our school needed to hire another full-time math teacher, and after more than a month of the job being open, there were only 3 applicants. In addition to harming recruitment efforts, the other major impact of our defined contribution system has been in retention. In the 8 years I've been teaching, many of my peers have left the profession for other careers, many moving to teach in states that offer defined benefit retirements. More and more of the conversations I have with my fellow Tier 3 defined contribution teachers are not about the long-term success of our schools, but instead about short-term job options and asking and answering the question, how long are you staying? And so now the decision falls on my plate. 2 years from now, I will have taught for a decade. My student loans should be paid off, and I should be done with the PhD program. At that point, I'll be faced with a very serious choice between continuing to stay here as an educator in Alaska or moving on to something else. Now, my first master's degree is in education, and I know that teaching is where I want to be and where my community needs me. However, my second master's degree is in economics, and I'm torn knowing that the smarter economic decision is likely to go teach in a different state or to move into private industry elsewhere. I appreciate the time you've taken at this hearing and throughout the session to consider House Bill 280. And while none of us can predict the future, I do know that in the coming years, I will be at a point where I need to decide whether to stay in education in Alaska or not. What I can tell you is that in making that decision, my top concern is the retirement system. Please continue to support House Bill 280 so that our state can get back to attracting and retaining the quality educators our students and communities need. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Who's next?
Jacob Barra. And if I could, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, give this.
I apologize if I mispronounce names. And I think it was Nathan or Chris Benchuk, I think is what he said. I said Benchu. But I just apologize. He corrected. We're okay. Okay.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the time. In the interest of time and not repeating a lot of the points, I would shorten my testimony. My name is Jacob Barra. I am an art teacher at Eagle River High School.
You what? Art?
An art teacher at Eagle River High School. I'd like to actually talk in terms of the perspective of a Tier 2 teacher. My wife and I are both educators, and we moved up in 2003. We were both graduates from college at that time and looking to start our career. And in terms of answering the question about what attracts teachers to Alaska, I can say that in my experience growing up, my mom always got the Alaska magazine and, you know, just the scenery of Alaska and the adventure for a couple without kids at that time. It was very attractive to move here.
Did it meet your expectations?
It did. Unbelievable. It's amazing how quickly you can get in the back of the country.
You moved up from where?
From Wisconsin.
Okay.
So, but I can also tell you without a doubt, we both came from pretty economically challenged families. And we were looking to find a place to potentially raise our own family. And we didn't want to, we wanted to break that cycle. And we didn't want a handout. We wanted to really earn that through some hard work. And so looking at the potential to earn a secure job in Alaska teaching, we learned that at a teaching job fair in Minneapolis. And then we researched the retirement system as well. And so as a Tier 2 person, it was attractive to move 3,500 miles away from everybody else that we love. And in that time, we've done well. You know, we have three kids now. We purchased a home in Shugiak, volunteer in our community, and I have a wonderful job. I absolutely love it, and I love my kids. And in that time as well, I've become a national board-certified teacher. But I also can tell you that the colleagues around me that were hired after 2006, that's a different story. I know that as they stay here longer and they start to point their direction forward, they're getting more nervous about what their situation is going to look like financially in 10, 15 years. When my wife and I think about staying here as Alaskans, you know, as a homeowner, we're also thinking in terms of, you know, I'm a taxpayer. You know, I want the fiscal future of the state to be healthy. And I completely understand, you know, the difficult decisions that legislators need to make right now. But my grandfather was the kind of guy that he saved a little bit more. He bought a little bit nicer things, and he made them last a long time. And I see teaching and the investment that we make in our teachers and our other public employees, I think now more than ever we have to sort of take that view. And I really believe that this bill is a really good effort in doing that, in helping to make sure that we're not spending more money retraining and recruiting more people who will leave in 5 years. And so, again, I don't want to repeat a lot of the other points that were already made. I will say that something that didn't come up is that Alaska is unique in that it's a DC-only plan, a defined contribution-only plan for public employees, but also the only state that additionally does not allow them to participate in Social Security. I believe there's one other state that has a DC plan, but you know, at the end of the day, those employees can participate in Social Security, so there's some sort of defined benefit option for them. Alaska is unique in that both don't exist. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Bruna, and I'm gonna pass and let her pronounce her last name. W-O-T-T-J. Go ahead.
Wadalovich.
And what is your name, and who do you represent?
My name is Bruna Wadalovich. I'm a teacher in Anchorage, Alaska.
Okay. Let's go to you.
I teach at Central Middle School. I'm a special education teacher.
Yeah.
I do language arts, study skills, and some behavior type.
And I was, some years ago, a special ed teacher at Romig.
At Romig? Okay. So I'm actually, like Jacob just said, changing a little bit. My colleagues have made some excellent points. And I also am a transplant. I'm from Minnesota. My dad brought me up here when I was younger for a trip, and I loved it, and I ended up moving here just kind of for an adventure. I was going to be here for 1 year and then leave. That was in 2007, and I own a house in Eagle River now, and I don't plan on leaving. But I do see my colleagues leaving, and it's already happening. It's not just happening in the bush. At Central Middle School, where I teach, last year two of our teachers left. And I can't say that they left just because they don't have a secure retirement through defined benefit, but I can say that it factored into it, definitely. When I was talking to them and they were discussing leaving, they were talking about raising a family. One had just gotten married and had just had a baby, and the other one was planning on it. And they did not see a secure future in staying here, and they were amazing teachers. We really lost a lot when those two left. And it's happening across the district, it's happening across the city, and it's happening across the state. And I'm really concerned about what that means for our students. If an office job is not filled, that means that there's not someone there in the chair working, right? But if a teacher job is not filled, what do we do with those students? They don't stay home because a teacher doesn't get hired or show up or apply. We have to do something, and usually that means we're putting them in another class, so then class sizes get bigger. It has a real direct effect on our students, and that greatly concerns me. The quality of education that we have here right now is excellent. I think that we're doing we are doing a really good job. We are really dedicated to the profession. But if we don't keep excellent teachers and we're not filling positions, that could start to change, and we don't want that. None of us want that. I don't think anybody wants to have a poor education system. And so doing this will allow us to attract and definitely retain the teachers that our state and our students really need. And that's why it's so important, and that's why I came here today to talk to you guys about it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Okay, fine. Thank you. Congratulations on your teaching.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just there's three left in the room. The next one is there just for questions. Kathy Lee from the Division of Retirement and Benefits, up to you, Mr. Chair, if you want to have a question for her or whatever.
Any questions from the committee for her? If not, go to the next one.
Okay, Sam Privet.
I believe he's coming up. We're going to have Sam for the answer. One more.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sam Trivett. I am here on behalf of myself this morning. I wear a number of hats, and I testified before a number of you in the past. A couple of my hats right now are that I'm still a volunteer with the Retired Public Employees. I'm not speaking on their behalf. I'm also still the vice chair of the Retirement Management Board. So in the information I'm going to present today, there have been a number of questions about Alaska data. And that's what I plan to give you some today. As everybody knows, the defined contribution system has been in place now for about 10 years. And we're at a point where, as the chair of the defined contribution committee, plan committee on the ARM board, we've been pulling together information and trying to get data out of the system in the last couple of years. We are at a point now where we have quite a bit, enough that I want to connect the dots in about three different areas. So I'm going to talk about three different areas. And for the record, I am a retired PERS. I had 33 years with the state of Alaska, all with the Department of Corrections and Marine Highways. Before I retired, I've been retired for 18 years, and I have continued to be involved in the public since that time. I'm a resident of Alaska since 1954. So the question you all have before you is that how well is the defined contribution retirement plan working? And the areas I want to talk about are briefly the health reimbursement arrangement. That is, how much money is in the health savings accounts these people have. Number two is, what are the DC account balances? How much money do people have in their accounts that have been in the system up to 10 years now? And what is the disbursement behavior of these people? In other words, when they leave either retirement or they're leaving for other reasons, what are they doing with the money? And that's a very critical point. Let me also just say for the record, I'm not an actuary. I'm not a lawyer. My degrees are in other things. And so I don't want anybody to think when I talk about numbers that I'm a CPA or lawyer or anybody else. Okay. Most of you know about the history of Senate Bill 141. I won't go into that. In terms of numbers of active employees, right now there are about 35,700 active employees, both DC and DB, in the state. Out of those, 17,000 plus are DB. Over 18,000 are defined contribution now. So you've seen the shift in this 10 years go from everybody in DB to over half of the PERS employees are now in the defined contribution. Teachers is not quite the same. It's 5,609 DB actives versus 4,965. So, but it's going that direction pretty rapidly. And we have over 32,700 retirees and beneficiaries in PERS and 12,429 retirees and beneficiaries in TERS. So one of the things that happened when Senate Bill 141 passed is that if you retired from the system, you had system-paid health care, and that's now shifted to money goes into a health reimbursement arrangement. So after 10 years of being in place now, assuming a person had worked all 10 years, they would have in their account, and I've asked for individual account balances, and realize now for every active employee, each employee has their own balance, okay? But we've made an assumption that if somebody was hired on day one and has worked all those years, right now, today, they would have about $17,500 in their HRA. Now, if you've got to pay premiums, and these people don't have a system provided, so they got to pay the premiums, you know that $17,500 wouldn't last very long. Okay. Let's talk about account balances, individual DC accounts. The average right now for everybody, public employees, is across the board, no matter how long they've worked, how many their ages, et cetera, is $73,957. So that is what they're expected to have to live on. If they were to walk out in retirement today, they would have $73,957. That does vary, and I have some data by age groupings. The highest, of course, is people that are aged now 59 to 62. They have about $119,450. Okay? If you go down to age 41 through 48, and we have it before that, too, the amount is $39,659. So that's how much they get. Probably one of the most important things is the disbursement. And this is a real concern for those of us that serve on the ARM board and especially on the DC committee. And there's three ways they've broken down the data. Number one is that people quit, they separate, okay? And they can either take the money out in cash, they can roll it over, and of course people can also retire from the system. And we have some real red flags here. Number one is the people that have quit and taken their money out or rolled it over. 76% did not go into any of the advisement seminars before they made those decisions. So they're not getting professional advice. Okay, that's a real problem. And the numbers are rather bothersome. I've decided to just focus on PERS. PERS numbers are similar, but the employees in FY11 took out about $7.1 million. They just quit and they took their money out. They didn't roll it over to an IRA. That number by FY15 was up to $21 million, okay? And accounted for over 76% of all the money dispersed in the 5 years, okay? So the pattern continues to go. I won't go into any more details about that, but that is a real major problem. Now, another issue that you folks have as legislators, and it's a financial issue too, is that if people are not rolling over their money to an IRA and they're spending it on their own expenses, What does that mean? When they do retire at some point in time, they probably won't have very much money. There is another NIRS, National Institute of Retirement Security study that has been around for a number of years now that shows that older Americans that don't have a defined benefit income are about 39% higher to be on means-tested public assistance. Okay? Now, everybody in this room knows that public assistance is all state funding. Okay? And across the U.S., in 2006 dollars, that was worth over $7.3 billion. And that's a real concern. So not having a defined benefit, it's going to take decades, but you're going to see it years down the line for people who don't have it. And I personally know a number of people in the state, having lived here since 1954, that even on fairly low wages that have a defined benefit, have decided to stay in Alaska and are getting by up here because they do have the DB. And, of course, as someone's already mentioned, it's since 1980, most public employees, certainly state employees, have not been in Social Security. And without having that as well, that just puts people in a horrible situation. It's going to put our state in a bad situation. And, again, for all those reasons and many others personally, I certainly strongly support House Bill 280 and would urge you to pass it out this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. Very interesting. Okay. Make it short, because I think we have about one more. We're running out of time for the whole committee here.
Sure.
Just for the record, I appreciate the statistics about the need for means-tested public assistance or welfare programs. And that is true, but you stated that means it involves state money. Not all programs are funded with just state money. For example, food stamps is 100% federally funded, Medicaid 50% and higher, and so forth. I mean, senior benefit is just state only. Anyway.
But there is quite a bit of state money going into that, is what I'm saying.
Not overall. Yeah. Overall, it's mostly 50-50.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Next in line is Greg Collins.
Thank you, Greg. Make it a little short if you can, because we might be able to take some action here, but we're supposed to end at 10 o'clock and everybody has places to go after that.
I understand.
Official place to go. Yes.
So my name is Gregory Collin, and I work for the Juneau School District, IT department. I just want to offer my support for House Bill 280. First, I'd like to thank Representative Tito for introducing this legislation. And
I co-sponsored it.
So I've been on Tier 4 for 7 years now. And, I mean, my biggest issue with it, and I know most of my coworkers as well who are on it, is just the uncertainty. Stock market. When we're going to retire.
Continue. I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir.
Right. So, I mean, the whole uncertainty with Tier 4 has always been my issue. How long am I going to live? I don't know. How's the stock market going to be doing next week, next year, 10 years? I don't know. When am I going to retire? How long am I going to be able to live? I don't know. There's so much uncertainty with it, and, you know, having the pool, Tier 5 or whatever this would be called, I think would give people the certainty they're looking for.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Charlie, rush you off there. Okay. Do we have anybody else on?
No, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Is anybody else online or in the room? No, oops, I closed the public testimony. This bill goes next to Labor and Commerce Committee. So any of the materials that we would need, that's supposed to be coming to us, we would receive and give it to the next committee of referral. Any comments from the from the committee, or what are their wishes? Don't everybody speak at one time, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would like to, I'd actually like to move the bill if somebody would do that.
Excuse me.
Because, yes, Representative Stewart.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we, let me look and see what the bill number is here. I'm sorry.
We might move the wrong bill.
Move House Bill 280 from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note, if any.
Thank you very much. Any objections? If not, the bill moves. Very excellent testimony today, I thought. You know, I'm a retired military person. I say to the military, you didn't have to get shot, because one of the reasons is, aside from liking my job, I knew to the penny how much I was going to make based upon my rank and time in service. And like I said earlier, previously, the same thing for my teaching career. Let me go to my staff for just a second. I can't read this. Okay. I'm advised by the person who really runs this place that the schedule has not been finalized. I would like to wish everybody a very, very happy Easter weekend, and we are adjourned.